This week on The Breezy Breakfast, we are joined by Guelph's Police Chief Gordon Kobe, Deputy Chief Steve Gill, and Inspector Andrew Goody. They explain the intricacies of policing, the budget, and staffing. Everything from traffic issues to drugs to human trafficking is discussed. 90 minutes passes quickly, and we do not get to all the questions that were asked. Over to our moderator, Phil Ault.
Good morning and welcome to the approximately 160th radio and podcast of the Breezy Brothers Breakfast, where the coffee is strong and the food for thought always gives you something to digest. To all, I wish a happy Black Heritage Month in Guelph. I want to thank you all for attending. I also wish to thank Rise and Shine for making us welcome. Thanks to our Dinah Deaver Bev and others who take our orders and miraculously keep our coffee and teacups full. And Bev, wherever you are, as I know you're not feeling well, we wish you a speedy recovery. As we embark on our eighth full year of community conversations at Breezy Breakfast, I remind us all that we are here to engage in thoughtful dialogue about issues that affect our neighborhoods, our community, our city, province, and often our nation and those throughout the globe. Before I begin, I wish to offer a territorial acknowledgement. As we gather, let us take time to reflect on our privilege to live and work in Guelph, a city built over rich Indigenous histories. We are guests here, and we should reflect upon the responsibility to care for this land, the people who live here today, and the generations to come. If our actions today can move us towards reconciliation, we should take pause and make those decisions with intention and gratitude. On a sad note, I wish to extend the sympathy of Breezy Breakfast to Guelph Gadfly and Guelph Today columnist and recent guest on Breezy Breakfast, Adam Donaldson. Adam's mother passed away this weekend. We wish our friend the best as he celebrates a life well lived while feeling the sadness of losing a parent. And now for the money business. I am now making an irregular request for funds. As I am sure you are aware, Breezy Breakfast operates on the kindness of strangers. We are nonprofit. All donations are used to provide honorary to guests and improvements to our equipment. Tanya, Morgan, and I are volunteers. If you think that Breezy keeps you informed of what is happening and what matters in Guelph, please consider a donation. I might also add that we are looking for volunteers to host and assist with the podcast, editing the radio show with ideas for guests and topics. And the bottom line on this is, if I can do this, anyone can. You remember that gift of gab you had that led your teacher telling your parents you need to listen more, talk less to that cutie sitting beside you in grade five? Well, you can forget that. As a volunteer on Breezy Breakfast, you can exploit your loquacious proclivity without the risk of detention. I am encouraging you to recruit cute guests as I have today. I give you permission to love them from afar for their minds and for their commitment to community. If you want to volunteer, speak to Morgan, Tanya, or me. For many of you, downtown is an issue. Drug use, loitering, tents are but a few concerns. Then there are speed cameras, the current hot topic with drivers who get nicked for going 50 in a 30-kilometer zone. Delicate topics like family violence and crimes of passion might arrive. We respect these, and they will be addressed carefully and compassionately. We also respect questions on police budgets and limits on police authority. How do the police know how to act? How do they know how to arrest, how to console, and how to give a break when it is needed? Please note, for those with a personal traumatic journey, we do respect your right to anonymity. Please only mention your name if you feel comfortable. And if you want to ask a question directly, we encourage you. But if you wish for me to ask it so you may keep your anonymity, I'm quite willing. Just send me a text. I remind people that Breezy Breakfast is a forum for rational, polite dialogue. I don't normally say this, but the topic of policing is an emotional one. Some have had family members who have been affected by crime. Some have had friends affected by crime. Please be mindful of the opinions expressed. They might sound outlandish to you, but I presume, and I'm sure, they come from a place of concern in the heart. And with that, I would like to welcome Chief Kobe and other representatives of the Guelph Police Force. Welcome, Chief Kobe. And as we begin, I've got an advanced question just to warm you up. Chief Kobe, it came in from Tanya. How many calls does the police service take every day, or perhaps it's easier to say every year or month? And I'm wondering if you can categorize those. Are they easily broken down into violent crime, crimes against the person, crimes of property? How do we do that?
First of all, before I answer the question, I wanted to thank you again, Phil, for the chance to be with you. I think the last time I was here, I gave everyone an open invite that we're always happy to come back. And I think Phil may have actually had a bit of a last minute invite when you invited me to come to this session.
I would have to say that this was a last minute stand in, almost like somebody who has to go on stage in Macbeth when they are just the understudy. So thank you very much for coming.
So I am always happy to come. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you. And also the two gentlemen here to my right, Deputy Chief Steve Gill and Inspector Andrew Goody. Steve is in charge of all of our operational resources. So pretty much everyone you see that dresses like this every day, kind of the operational side of our organization. And Andrew is now newly responsible for all of our community resource initiatives. So our community resource officers, our downtown team, a host of other areas, including traffic and numerous other things. So Andrew, I wanted Andrew and Steve to be here today because I think it's really important that they hear our questions, they hear your concerns, because I think that's much more effective than me going back and telling them about it. So I want them to feel from you what the community is feeling and asking. So with that, to answer your first question, we do have every year we have an annual report. We have made a very conscious effort to make sure that we provide every year a very comprehensive, very detailed annual report with respect to our calls for service. Last year we had approximately 85,000 calls for service. And so if you can imagine, that's every call that comes into our dispatch office. So some of those might be things like drop 911 calls or 911 calls that are by accident, but even each of those have to be followed up appropriately. To give you a frame of reference, that's about 10,000 more calls than we had 2 or 3 years ago. And so on average, this is a very rough average. It's probably around 200 a day, some days slightly less, some days considerably more. And those calls to every day range from the most routine calls to the most serious. Anyone who had an opportunity to watch any of our recent budget delegations and budget discussions at the board and council, our members, the 350 men and women of the Guelph Police Service, they literally help our community navigate life's most difficult moments. Our community's probably be surprised to know this, but in approximately the last 5 years, our members have attended to over 1,000 sudden deaths or homicides or tragic motor vehicle accidents. So if you can imagine the cumulative impact of all those responses. So what I'd really encourage, I can't do all the numbers justice. All you have to do, and I'm sure Phil can provide a link, we have our most recent annual report. It's totally available and accessible online. And in fact, we've recently evolved to a more, I think, user-friendly experience for the annual report. So in that, it breaks down calls for service types, numerous other things, response times. I think right now we hover around 6 minutes response time for priority one calls. So for the most serious calls. And that's come down in the last few years. I think between 21 and 22, we were up about 6 seconds, which is still considerably better than where we were 5 years ago. But those are all the trends, Phil, if that's helpful, that's in our annual report.
Thank you. And that actually leads to a number of other questions. The first of which I'm going to ask you, you talked about getting your response time down by 6 seconds, which doesn't seem much to me unless you're Maple Leafs and just about to lose a hockey game. 6 seconds, why does that matter?
Well, and in fact, so it's not. So in 2019, so for anybody who's keeping score, I got here in March 1st of 2019. So we're just coming up to, I guess it'll be my fifth anniversary. My fifth anniversary, March 1st. In 2019, we had reached record high call volumes, record high response times, record high crime severity index, things like that. So since 2019, our response times have steadily come down significantly. Between 2021 and 22 last year, they went up, albeit just six seconds, but it's noteworthy in the sense that it's our job to be noticing that trend. Because for several years, they were going up quite consistently. They've come down for a couple of years, and now they came up marginally. So why that's important? our priority one response time represents the time it takes for us to serve our citizens in the most serious situations. So if you call the police and a loved one needs our assistance, you're worried about your personal safety to your family, your property, that's how long it takes us to get in the most serious situations. So,
okay. Now, that leads to a number of other questions. And perhaps the first one I'll start off with is just a very simple one. In your opinion, and perhaps the opinion of our other guests, is Guelph a violent city? Do we need to be on top of violence? And should people be more concerned about threats to human safety now than, say, 5 years ago? What's your opinion on that?
Well, short answer is yes, we should always be concerned. And I would say that if we were the safest city in the country, we should still be concerned because we should never be complacent. So, again, if we go back to 2019, I'll go back a little bit further. For many years, Guelph, and as a resident here for the last 25 years or so, and I can see some in the crowd have been here much longer than 25 years. We were the safest city in the country for many, many years. And by that, I mean, there's 35 census metropolitan areas in Canada. And we were the first or second safest census metropolitan area in the country for many years. And I think that was a point of pride for all of us. From about 2012 to 2018, we went from being the second safest CMA in the country to the 19th safest CMA out of 35. And that happened in 6 years. So that's the kind of trend that we need to see as it's evolving, because it's much easier to keep us at a certain ranking than to try to get back. So fortunately, with the support of our board and council and the community, we've seen a consistent improvement. So in 2018, we were at 19th, and we've come up now the trend. We're at 12th out of 35.
What type of incidents are driving that change? I mean, is it a rise in homelessness? Is it a rise in carjackings by people from other cities, whatever?
So that ranking is the overall crime severity index. And all of this information is, like, if you were to just Google Canada Crime Severity Index, it's going to give you a plethora of information. But essentially, the overall crime severity index is a weighted average between the violent crime and the nonviolent crime. And so it's kind of, for example, if you have violent crimes like major assaults, break and enters, versus less violent things, like thefts, that's a weighted average of the two. So in answer to your question, though, in around 2017-18, Guelph, and you guys could correct me if I'm wrong, there was like a historic increase in like auto theft and things like that, property crime. So I think it would be naive to think that there's not some property crime that's associated to folks who struggle with homelessness and addictions. But that's a weighted average. But if I can just finish off kind of the theme of my discussion there, because Phil had asked an important question. We've gone from second, in 5 years, 5 or 6 years, we went from second to 19th. We've made our way back up to 12th. So while that is great progress, I don't think we should be complacent or not realize our goal is for Guelph to be the healthiest and safest community in the country. So that's our goal. So we're evolving, right? So for example, last year, our service investigated 4 homicides. In recent or recorded memory, I don't think you've been here 25 years. We've never seen that before. That's the most we've ever seen. We would typically, on average, probably have 1 or 2. 2 would be a significant in 1 year. So 4 for us last year alone, that is a very, very significant increase. So these are the things we need to remain alive to, not become complacent, and remember, like, the very large urban centers that are our neighbors, we're not immune to the crime trends happening in those places. So
I just want to follow up on that before I get to some of the questions that I've got here. When I was growing up, there were years when it was very rare in Guelph to have any murders at all. Now, you've identified 4 homicide calls this year, which I find to be astonishing. I was wondering if there is any way to break those numbers out or the pathology of them? Are those domestic? Are they random? How do we understand the severity of crime and the likelihood of crime affecting us in the household?
Some of those things may be for the courts, so I have to be mindful of that. I think it's safe to say that the crime trends in other large urban centers are playing a role in those numbers.
Yeah, so I would say, again, without getting into a whole lot of detail, because I can't, but certainly one of those homicides, I would say, was interfamily type homicide, so domestic related. And then of the other homicides, I would say they resulted in perhaps other criminal factors playing a role in that. So in other words, people involved in other criminal aspects, perhaps drugs, human trafficking, those types of things, we are seeing coming into our city more and more. When those types of crimes come into our city, of course, it has an impact on our community members. So that's very high level, I know. But like the chief said, many of these things are before the courts. So I'll leave it at that.
Yes, and that's one thing that I do have to apologize for. When I talked about open and transparent, there are very clearly things that cannot be talked about here. And I want to be very clear that that's because due process must be followed, and we need to be very mindful of that. I'm going to go to a couple of questions. I've got Morgan and Donna and Tanya that have got questions.
Thanks, Phil. Just a quick question about the OR, given that, you know, they're looking at hopefully doing a urban park, and it belongs to the provincial government right now. If something happens on the OR lands, who's the responding service?
Well, we would be responsible to respond to things within the city of Guelph. As far as the development of the property and all that stuff, that would be a city, a provincial, all that stuff. But we are responsible to respond within the city of Guelph.
So the correctional centers are just on the periphery. That is on the city, in the city. So it would be the responsibility of of our force. Steve, did you want to make a comment on that?
No, I was just going to say, yeah, they are certainly within the city. So we would attend there. Years ago, when it was operational, sometimes we would actually attend out there to investigate incidents that happened on the property. So, yes, it's certainly within our jurisdiction we would attend.
Okay, thank you. And I think that's important for people. And the reason for that, I'm going to do a follow-up. There are roads within the city and there are highways within the city. And then there is the Hanlon Expressway, which is a highway. And I think many people get confused with jurisdictions and sometimes confuse the role of the Guelph Police Services with that of the OPP. I was wondering if you could help us understand where those jurisdictions come in and where they don't.
Yeah, so it's in a way almost somewhat contradict. Certainly the Hanlon Expressway is within the city of Guelph boundaries. But it is a provincial highway that the OPP are responsible for. So for patrolling, you'll see, for those of you who travel up and down, you'll often see an OPP cruiser doing enforcement. If there's collisions on the highway, OPP is responsible for that as well. That being said, what we do, if there's a very serious collision, we of course, will attend and assist the citizens until OPP shows up. They'll be responsible for the reporting of that collision, but we certainly help them out and help out whoever is in that collision.
Great, thank you. Donna Jennison, you had a question.
Good morning. There was an article in the Star recently that I just wondered if you had some comments on. The headline was, I'm just pulling it up here, police spending has no consistent correlation with lower crime rates, new Canadian study says. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to speak about that. So I have not read that entire study. I can't speak to the variables. I can't speak to the scientific method. I can't speak to anything that what have come out of that survey. What I can say is our experience locally here is in the last 5 years, we've gone from the we've gone from the 19th out of 35 census metropolitan areas in the country with respect to a community safety ranking to 12th. So, and I think anybody who has been around since I've been here, certainly Phil, as a member of council, I've advocated very strongly for the last 5 years that as one of Canada's fastest growing communities, as one of Ontario's fastest growing communities, for many years, the growth of the service didn't keep pace with the growth of the community. And I believe that that played a role in how we went from second out of 35 to 19th. So just our personal experience here, as we have increased investment, we have gone from, as I say, 19th to 12th. Response times have improved. And we've also been able to significantly increase, for example, our support to the downtown. If we go back about 5 years, I think there would probably be, I don't know all of these numbers exactly, but there might have been a couple hundred, 200 or 300 documented patrols, preventative patrols in our downtown. I think last year we were approaching 1,300 documented proactive patrols in our downtown. So I guess the best answer I can give, I can't speak to that study. I know our local experience here has been quite compelling. As we've been able to invest, we've been able to greatly increase the service we've been able to provide. And that's been captured both in response times and overall crime severity.
Now, a point was raised by one of the guests online that they're questioning whether there was causation or correlation. But I am going to try to go at it a slightly different way because maybe we can expand on that. The one question that I think people are constantly wondering is, what are the factors that drive budget? And does the size of Guelph and does the expansion of Guelph have an impact? I guess I'm also asking you, for what population does Guelph police and how does that affect budget as well?
So again, I would really encourage everybody, our board meetings, I believe October 5th was the board presentation. So we worked really hard as we built our multi-year budget to provide the community as much data that we could. We also engaged KPMG to do a study, a resourcing study for us. For anyone who recalls, KPMG, they did a city review, and then the year following, they did a review for us. So our community growth. So if you were to look at, and everything I'm talking about is included in our budget docs that's online. There are in the province of Ontario, 9 tier 1 municipalities between 100 and 500,000. And based on our review of those 9 communities, if we look at a current value assessment, kind of an investment in policing of those 9 communities, only Chatham-Kent invests less per current value assessment than the city of Guelph. So the investments that the board and council approved were designed to kind of bring us to kind of start to approach that average investment of other communities, certainly not aiming to be the highest invested, but kind of an appropriate, so balancing service with affordability. So Phil knows I could talk about this for a couple hours.
Yeah, we love our numbers. Just related to that, though, when we've been dealing with the budget, and this is somewhat of an internal question, but not really, we are looking at getting our staffing up to an optimum level. The way that I recollect it, we will not be there for 3 years. Is that correct? We're slowly increasing our staffing complement. Am I right on that, or is my memory failing?
Yes, you are right. So essentially, based on the work done, and there's a number of things that I'd encourage the community to look at. There's a thing called the Ontario Financial Information Return. That's kind of how municipalities report finances, etc. But based on the work that was done, for us to be at the 2023 average, there were certain recommended resource enhancements or growth. Those point in time recommendations we've phased in over the 4-year multi budget. So when we get to 2027, we will be at what would have been the 2023 average. So, and the reality is we needed to balance affordability with growth of the service.
And related to that, one of the things that has always struck me as odd as both a city councilor and as a GPS board member is that policing within the city is reliant upon property taxes. Now, this drives me crazy. It strikes me that there should be a greater role for the province. And yet it seems to me that all of it has been put on the police services. And that's often what I heard during budget, that the police budget is just way too much of our city budget. I don't know whether you can comment on the role of the province in this, on the role of the province in governance, and how that might help us understand budgeting and financing of the police services.
I can't comment on the province. I think overall, I believe that we have responsibility to effectively and transparently manage the human and financial resources entrusted to us by the community. All of the information that we rely on, whether it be KPMG, whether it be the Ontario Financial Information Return, whether it be kind of other budget related documents, those are all open source. So I'd really encourage people to take the time to do that. But no, I'm not going to, the provincial thing, I'll let you guys sort that out.
In your experience, whether it be 5 years that you've been in Guelph or in other
30, words, just over 30 now.
No, I was thinking as a chief of police.
Yeah.
But in other law enforcement organizations, there's an awful lot that goes on within a community, municipality, Toronto or a small hamlet just up the road that doesn't always get reported to the police. And I think in Canada, it's generally recognized that domestic violence and sexual assault are probably the greatest in terms of severity, unreported crimes that are going on. In your experience, has there ever been an attempt for the police forces here or elsewhere to get together with other social service agencies and try and figure out what is really going on and what do these various agencies have to do? Who should be doing what in order to deal with the situation?
That's an excellent, excellent question. And I know council has recently talked about this. So Deputy Chief Gill, I'm gonna hand the mic to him in a second because he's got a great deal more experience here in Guelph than I do. But I think the foundation to your question is, first and foremost, we want to ensure we have the trust of our citizens so that they know they can call us. And also the trust of our community stakeholders so that we can have a really effective, collaborative way of approaching such an important thing together. So Steve spent many years working on that. So I'm going to let you talk about some of those partnerships.
Thank you. And thank you for the question. It's a very good question. I can tell you, prior to coming to Guelph to work, I came here in 2001. Prior to that, I worked in Toronto. And I would say it's fairly consistent across police services. But certainly in Guelph, we are very fortunate to have very strong relationships with various organizations that deal exactly in that matter. So, for example, Women in Crisis, the Guelph General Hospital. There's a number. And I can tell you, we're very fortunate. One of our employees is actually the coordinator of the Ontario Domestic Violence Investigators Group, Ashley MacArthur. And we are actually going to have a presentation, I think the next board meeting, at our next public board meeting, from the inspector who oversees investigative services, who will be presenting on domestic violence specifically. The one other thing I would add to your list, sir, is human trafficking, right? Human trafficking often is related to domestic violence as well and often goes unreported. But we have a lot, we're very fortunate. We do have a lot of partners. Like I said, Women in Crisis, Victim Services, Guelph General Hospital, Sexual Assault Center. We all work collaboratively together as best we can in terms of exchanging information based on you know, different situations and trying to look at the needs specifically of the victims, right? We want to help victims as much as we can. And so we're continuously trying to improve in that area. You know, I can tell you, I think last year we had 1,500 plus reported domestic violence incidents. The year before that, it was 1,600. So that's a lot of incidents to be properly investigated and a lot of victims to be supported. So we certainly try our best in that area and look forward to continuing to improve, serve the community.
A follow-up from Mike.
With your incident investigations, you accumulate an incredible amount of data as to what is actually going on, which may or may not lead to criminal proceedings or this sort of thing. Has there been any attempt to have students, professors, what have you, who are at the community college or at the university level in criminology studies, or even in standard psychology studies or sociology studies, to go through that data and try and get a different appreciation as on a collective basis, which an individual officer wouldn't have a chance to do, to try and figure out what is really going on here? Are there trends that we should be concerned about? Should we be equipping our officers somewhat differently in order to deal with whatever situations may appear?
Thank you very much for that question. So in terms of the university, I can tell you we do have a relationship with the university. We're looking at collaborating with them on some courses. Just earlier this week, we met with Conestoga College, who is consulting, basically looking to come out with a degree course in policing. And we discussed, you know, what is the best way to work with them. Currently, not as far as I'm aware, do we have a program such as you're suggesting? I can tell you, we are certainly open with the university. We have a good relationship with them. We have an event on the 5th. I think it's February 5th with them, and we work with their community justice and social program. We have had conversations. You know, we do have an educational institute right in our backyard. We're open to working with them. But I, as far as I know, there has not been any studies based on what you said. Now, that being said, I think there's broader studies that the domestic violence group that I mentioned our officer is the chair of, that they work on. But that's I wouldn't be able to tell you the specifics on that. But you might want to watch the next board meeting to get some information there.
Our board meetings, I don't have the calendar memorized, but they're always the third Thursday of the month, except a voice in the audience tells us it's the 22nd of February, 2:30.
I just want to unpack some of the comments made by Deputy Chief Gill. The issue of human trafficking is one that is tremendously tragic and affects people in many ways unbeknownst to us. I have heard that the preponderance of human trafficking occurs within circles that are very close, that quite often we actually break down the pathology of it, we find that there's a correlation between friends, acquaintances, and family in human trafficking. Is that a fair statement that I've read, or is that an inaccuracy? What are we dealing with?
Well, truthfully, I think it would be, because I'm not doing that work every day, I think it would be better to actually wait to the board meeting so our experts can give that. I don't think I can do that question justice.
Okay, no, that's fine. I didn't know it was coming up.
But I will say, in order for us to properly answer those questions, but properly, most importantly, support those in need, we always have to be mindful. Like, we do not have a dedicated human trafficking team. So, like, this is a very, very, such an incredibly important issue that traumatizes so many people. And over the years, I think we did have a partnership with where we had one person who was working with Waterloo Region. But those are the types of areas that we need to, as one of the largest, I think maybe we're the 14th biggest city in the province. We need to be realizing that we have responsibility to appropriately investigate these types of things. So that's all part of the investments that we always speak of when we talk about policing. We need to have the ability, which currently we do not. We do not have that ability to have a dedicated team for such an important thing.
And does the OPP have a dedicated team dedicated to human trafficking? Are we aware?
Yeah, they would have. There'd be a lot of joint teams throughout the province, as well as Waterloo.
Okay. And just I want to carry on with that for a bit, because the issue of human trafficking, I think, carries over into the more prevalent issue, and equally as significant or more significant, is that of family violence, and also that of drugs and drug trafficking. Are there correlations between any of those, the drug trafficking, human trafficking, family violence?
Thank you. And thanks for the question. So when we were working on the community safety and well-being plan, one of the pillars of that plan that was brought forward was the program of ACEs. And it basically, it's trauma-informed education. And so ACEs refers to adverse childhood experiences. And what science has proven is that when children live in toxic stress all the time, it impacts how they develop. So this really supports the old saying, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree position. But it's important for us to have an understanding of that, because there's a victim offender overlap many times. So many of our offenders at one point have been victims. And so it's certainly important for police to have an understanding of the trauma that the people we are dealing with have faced in the past. And that impacts how we deal with them. And so that could be certainly drug use, Phil, that has impacted them from a young age and carries on throughout their life. It could be their parents using substances as well, that has that negative impact. So it's very important to have that trauma-informed understanding in dealing with victims as well as offenders.
And just a comment that I see coming up here from, I'll just use the initial J. I think this is a really good point from Mike. What are we learning from these situations? How can we reduce the numbers? And I think what I'm hearing you state is that we have in progress, things that are addressing this. And with that, I'm actually going to turn the microphone over to a social worker who's in the audience as well. Oh, Steve?
That'd be great. And so we've worked with CHC, the Community Health Center, and what they are actually going to be providing all frontline officers within our organization training this year. They're part of our training program. So this trauma-informed training is going to be shared with all of our officers.
Okay, and I think we'll come back to that in a bit. But I've got Angela, who is a social worker with CMHA, who I think has a couple of remarks or questions.
Non-CMHA-related question. I don't think it's a big secret that over the last few years, there's been kind of a shift. And often people, they go into bail court and out the door they go. So it's called catch and release. You often see this referenced in conversations, both in person and online. And obviously, this is not something that police have any control over. But what I'm interested in knowing is, has this affected the decisions that individual officers might make when deciding whether or not to bother apprehending somebody, if they feel that it's like, is it going to be worth their time kind of thing? I'm wondering if that's happening, if you're getting a sense of that.
That's a great question. So, Andrew, I'm coming to you because Andrew just left our court section, so he's very well versed in this. I'm going to set the table for Andrew by saying we operate within the confines of existing legislation, and we are required to follow certain rules and procedures when it comes to arrest and release, so things like that. Andrew spent several years actually leading all of our court folks and all that stuff. So I'm going to let Andrew touch that.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you. Excellent question. And really, I think you're looking at, do some of these decisions influence our officers' behavior? And I would argue that no, a lot of our officers are very dedicated to the cause and intent that they put behind it. And as the chief said, many of the investigations that we do are guided by legislation. And in certain cases, we're absolutely obligated to ensure that the person who's arrested appears before a bail court. We also recognize that for the ones that do get released, there are also that many more who are held in custody or are put onto appropriate conditions that allow police to follow and follow up on. So you go back to your original point. No, I don't think it's influencing their behavior. They have a real dedication to ensuring that we're following what we're supposed to do.
I'm just wondering, with all the things that our police officers see in the field, the crashes, the accidents, everything they go through, what kind of psychological support do the officers receive on a regular basis and for their families as well? Because they're going to be the brunt of whatever their spouses see.
That is, so first of all, sir, I am grateful for you asking that question. And again, for anyone who has time, I'd really encourage you, if you could watch our October 5th board meeting. I think the budget presentation starts at minute 56. I've just saved you 56 minutes. It's riveting TV though, folks. The board meetings are riveting TV. Our members, as I said before, we have 350 people who help 150,000 people navigate life's most difficult moments. And to your point, Andrew, Steve, and I, and virtually all of our members have been to many, many difficult situations. An example, a story that I relate in the budget presentation I'm referring to you is that often, so just imagine, many of us are parents in this room. It is a very common occurrence for our folks to not only go to tragic scenes, traffic accident scenes, but then they leave that scene and they go to a home and they tell a mom or dad that their son or daughter's not coming home. And then as just, and it's incredibly sad that this is normal for them. They leave that house, they get in their car, they get on the radio and they get their next call. So as I said before, in the last, since January 1st, 2017, I believe to last year, our members have gone to over 1,000 sudden deaths or homicides or death investigations. So if you can imagine the cumulative impact of that. Now, to your point, what supports do we have in place? 5 years ago, we did not have a dedicated person whose job it was to provide wellness supports to our members. If you can imagine that. So now we have a dedicated wellness support person. She is a former CMHA mental health clinician who actually would spend many years on our impact team. So Tracy has been working really hard to kind of proactively help our members. We also have different programs, kind of regular supports for folks involved in certain work areas. But it really is, policing is an incredibly difficult function. And it's our job. If we are going to ask 350 people to support 150,000, we have to support them and their families in that process.
Before we get to the question that is being asked by someone in the restaurant, I want to follow up on the question of that has been asked, which essentially relates to stress, burnout, PTSD, and the health of the police corps. Give us the rundown on the challenges that we've been debating for the last couple of years on overtime.
So last year, like I said, we had a record number of homicides. We had a record number of protests, a record number of other things. For many years, we have relied on members to constantly work overtime all the time. I know I mentioned this when I was here last time. Most days. So today we should all kind of, I think today, I haven't seen today's briefing, but probably right now today, there's 10 cars on the road for this entire city of 150,000 people. So we have more, well, we probably have almost three times as many people. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. If you were to sit here at this table, that's how many people we have right now in this city to support 150,000. This table plus two. So, if you can imagine, if two of you went to an accident and three more went to a very difficult call and you guys each had one routine call, that's everybody working right now and nobody's had a lunch break and nobody got a chance to go to the bathroom. So that's our situation right now. And I think it's my job to be transparent. That's what the community should know. So having said that,
the resource enhancement that the board and council have approved will now let us start to reduce some of that. We can't have a business model where it relies on people to work 200-400 hours of overtime a year. Like if we look at, say, for example, if somebody works 400 hours of overtime, that's 10 weeks. That's 10 weeks more if you look at a 40-hour week. So that's the, again, that's the service, the wellness while balancing against affordability, which is why the enhancements were phased in over 4 years. And it's important. The board also has heard me talk many times. There's a law in Ontario called presumptive legislation that basically says if a first responder, so police, fire, ambulance, dispatch, if they are diagnosed with an operational stress injury like post-traumatic stress disorder, that is automatically deemed to be work-related. So in our industry, we probably are around maybe 10 to 14, 15% of people who understandably, after going to all those car accidents, after telling all those moms and dads, they need time away from work. Until this year, with the support of board and council, we never had a process to properly backfill those spots. So if I need time away from work, my unit of 10 just became a unit of 9. And so the work keeps increasing and the number of people keep decreasing. And so that's what we're trying to do, is to kind of get those supports. Now we're going to be able to support people who are away from work while also supporting who are here doing the very important job of supporting our citizens.
Before we get to a question in the audience in the restaurant, point was raised by Dee in the chat that I think it's very important for us to recognize those same factors that affect police also affect paramedics and other emergency services as well. I have not firsthand, but experienced very closely the impact of trauma on our paramedics and the PTSD that they suffer oftentimes in the act of attempting to revive someone or keep them alive until they get to hospital. And just a comment on the state of our healthcare system and all that, we could probably do all of our frontline workers a favor if we would fund those services much better. But that's my provincial comment. Ron.
Thank you. I'd just like to ask, there one of the other areas that goes most unreported as crime is cybercrime. You know, with one third of the population now over 60, there's a lot of scamming going on. There's child exploitation, as we heard from the United States. There's a great deal, and this is increasing. And I think with the advent of AI, it's going to explode. Do you have any resources at all to deal with a very difficult area in crime, is cybercrime?
That's a heck of a question. Actually, I'm even going to ask Chief Kobe, have we ever had any experiences with police services being held to ransom on cybercrime? And that's a serious question.
We have not with respect to that, because we appropriately have measures in place for security. Now, with respect to your question, you are exactly correct. It is one of the fastest growing situations we're dealing with. We do have a very limited ability. We do not have near the ability to invest again. And that's another reason for these phased in investments that was part of last year's budget. We do not have we're not even close to being able to give that the time and attention it deserves. I don't want to sound too dramatic there, but we're not even close to where we need to be, right? There's a lot of provincial work. There's joint teams. There's different things. It is an overwhelming, it's like drinking from a fire hose. And we're nowhere near, we're on our way to getting there. But that is, and again, it's a really important for me to advise. And all this is open source, folks. Like it's on the city's budget or our website. The enhancements required, if we would have taken all the enhancements required and onboarded all of them this year, we'd really be able to start to actually have an impact in areas like that. But we couldn't do that. It wasn't viable. So that's the enhancements that we would have needed this year, we're going to take 4 years to get there. So imagine what the trend in volume is going to look like in 4 years. So it's that constant
work, important work, to balance service expectations with affordability. But with that balance and that phase-in approach, there's jeopardy that comes with that. And the not being able to investigate as many of those as we should and the community deserves us to is part of that jeopardy. And Phil's heard me say many times, I've been pretty transparent about the jeopardy that comes with certain things.
Two-part question, Chief. We've seen in the news recently about the Ottawa situation and the ridiculous ruling by the courts. Two-part question. So, in your words, without giving us the party line, you tell us what you think about how ineffectual the police were in Ottawa, and which led to the actions that were taken subsequently. That's the first part. Second part is, what would you do if the situation happened here in Guelph?
It's a great question. So truthfully, I wasn't at those tables. I wasn't in the city. I can't comment on a situation that other folks had to deal with. I don't know if that's the party line. That's Gord's line. That's the truth. I cannot comment on what other folks had to deal with. With respect to our community, every situation we have to navigate, and there are many, many complex things that we navigate each and every time, we have to look at the situation, what are our legal authorities, and what's the right thing to do. And that's a process that we go through every single day. It's impossible for me to speak hypothetically about things, because every issue, every encounter has to be weighed on its own merit, working with our community. I think what we need to always be doing is discussions like this. We need to always be building trust and hearing and learning, so that when we have to confront really difficult situations, we can come at that from a relationship of trust. But I'm sorry, I can't comment on hypotheticals, and I can't comment on stuff I wasn't part of.
Okay, and thank you. I'm going to go to Bill and then Aaron.
Hi, I'm going to go straight to the mundane. As someone who drives within the speed limit within the city, I am often beeped at from the guy behind, or somebody comes roaring past. I know you guys have done very well with speed limits along with the city council at schools. That's great. And there are some red light cameras and things like that. But it's still happening. There's still an awful lot of aggressive, fast-driving people in this city. And it has, so far, it's limited in a few places, but not in most residential areas. What can you do, or what can you recommend to the city that they do to try and slow people down and change the mentality?
Well, that's another great question. So I think it's important, and Phil, probably as a member of council, would be even better. The police do not set speed limits. We do not install traffic cams, and we do not install speed cameras. So that's through council and the city and road safety priorities and initiatives. We work closely with them, but those types of things, the police don't do that. So as far as what can we do to keep our roads safe, I've been a chief for 5 years, and I've been a cop for almost 31. I was 10 when I started, folks. And I have learned two things in 31 years of policing. Nobody wants a ticket, but everybody wants safe roads. So we have a responsibility to work to do that. Do you know how many traffic folks we have today? Do we have one or two? One. We got one traffic person on the road today. So we have 10 people going to frontline calls. We got one traffic person on the road. People are probably surprised when I tell them that. So that's all part of the education, the engagement, the working with the city. But we got one traffic person on the road today. So that's part of, again, what we're trying to get better at, is to have the ability to give the community. So whether it be speeding or aggressive driving, or we've had folks passionately delegate to council about the importance of noisy vehicles, or like motor vehicle safety and kind of commercial vehicle safety operations and stuff. Those are all important areas that we're trying to get better at.
with a reasonable bandwidth to have more proactive ability to do that stuff.
Follow-up question, you don't have enough officers to be able to handle that. So we'd have to rely on technological, either very simple ones like speed bumps or speed cameras, whatever. What would you ask the city to do to provide for those kinds of things that would reduce the problem?
And I think the city's working really hard. So they actually have like professional traffic planners and people who are, so we're engaged in those discussions. So I can't really, I think the city's doing their best to manage those issues. I'm sure that probably through council, you'd actually know better who the actual traffic folks are. But to be honest, I don't have any suggestions for them because that's not my like speed in speed bumps and infrastructure and stuff. That's not our expertise. But I know they work closely with us. They really, really are trying to do their best.
Yep. And I'll pipe in, and then I'm going to move on to Aaron and then Brian. It's a good question, and it's good because I receive a number of emails a day on speeding through school zones and red light cameras right now. I actually am in favor of slowing everybody down, in particular me. That said, now that I know there's only one traffic officer on the road, after this is over, we're racing for pink slips down Wyndham Street. But quite seriously, it is the traffic department, and I would encourage anybody who is concerned about dangerous driving and about how we address issues of dangerous driving, and I'll lump anything from failing to stop at a stop sign to going down a residential street too quickly as dangerous driving. I'm not giving you a technical definition. Please contact city councilors and traffic at Guelph.ca. They are the people to whom you must address these issues. And I think that's very important. I'm just going to ask Chief Kobe to follow up on that. What many people do not understand is the separation of authorities. And I think, Chief Kobe, can I tell you how to police the city?
No.
There you have it.
And I wanted to follow. I'm going to touch real quickly on the traffic thing. Always call us. So if you're in a neighborhood and there's high, you feel there's a lot of speeding, our traffic folks absolutely prioritize those. And they get a lot of call-ins as far as areas that there's concerned. We have a well-established system. You can call into our traffic office. They will prioritize those areas for proactive enforcement. There's other things like we can install equipment to find out over the last 5 days on a certain street, the average speed was this, to kind of get a data-based way to prioritize our response. So that's absolutely, in addition to city, you can call us. So I don't want you to ever think you can't call us. As far as authorities, operational direction. So that's how it works. So people often, they just aren't aware of that. The Police Services Act lays out very clearly that I and our team, we have the responsibility to deliver policing. The board or council, they do not direct how operations are conducted. They do not direct how resources are deployed. So the short answer is no.
And just to follow up on the traffic part, I often have stated somewhat glibly that the slowest moving department in the city is the traffic department. And there's a reason for that. The real challenges with engineering street safety are massive. And we try to get it right. We don't always get it right first time. And quite often it's because there's a tremendous amount of public pressure from people that are saying they want this, that, or the other on their streets. And we have countless streets in Guelph. And everybody, I believe, rightly so, believes that the street in front of their house is the main priority of the city, when in fact we've got to prioritize everything. I have a number of questions, and I think at this point I'm going to go to Aaron Caton, Councillor Caton, and then to Brian Holstein with a couple of questions. Then I've got a number of pieces of paper passed to me and questions that I have on paper as well. So Councillor Caton out there in Cyberland.
So I just wanted to jump in on the speed camera thing real quick. because we just moved them. So today is a new day for where the speed look like the location of the cameras. So we were at Clearfields Drive East, Exhibition Street near Victory Public School, Brandt Ave near the school, and on Severn Drive near the school. So if you only pay attention to your speed when you think you're going to get caught, now's the time to pay attention in those areas. So I personally am very happy that this was done because the city has kind of done it based on survivability rates. So the speeds are the way they are because at 30, you have a much higher chance of surviving getting hit by a car than you do at 40. And it just kind of goes down in terms of survivability for there. But my question for the chief and deputy chief is about hate crimes and harassment and for minority communities. So I personally have had reasonable amount of this and a lot more recently. And I was wondering if you could talk through the steps that someone takes when they are getting harassed, if they feel that they are the victim of a hate crime. What would somebody do in the public?
Sure. Again, all of these units work for Steve, so I'm going to let him answer in a second. But I think the first most important thing is no one should ever have to feel unsafe. And if they do, they should call us. That's the most important thing, is that we can't help folks if we don't know about what's going on. So I'm going to give Steve a chance to kind of talk about the process. But what we really want in our community is building that trust and that connection and the education so people know when in doubt, call us. If they're not sure, call us. And Steve, you can walk through kind of the process.
Thank you. And thank you for the question. I would say sometimes people get confused with hate crime reporting, and I'll try and keep this fairly simple. So within the criminal code, there's certain hate crimes that are listed within the criminal code, and we only charge with those. We need approval before we lay those charges, but those are not normally the charges that we deal with. We often deal with hate incidents. So hypothetically, somebody assaults somebody because of their gender, their sexuality, their color, something along those lines. And that's a hate incident, right? And so it's an aggravating factor that we write into reports that go before the courts, and the courts take action appropriately. But what I encourage people to do, if they are involved in any type of hate incident, whether we can actually lay a criminal charge or not, they should be reporting it, because we want to know this information. If we have hateful folks in our community that are saying nasty things, and maybe they're not stepping over the boundary, so to speak, in a particular incident, the more we know about their activities, the more important it is, because it might be they're pushing the boundaries for a while, but when they step over those boundaries, these previous incidents may be able to provide a better picture for the courts. So they see where this individual is coming from and help establish that the hate overtone that's involved with the crime. Does that make sense?
It does. And so in one of my personal incidences recently, I learned about defamation in the criminal sense. So say someone is posting things about you and starting a campaign calling you groomer, child mutilator, pedophile, and those sorts of things. So what would you consider the recourse for that?
So I don't know all the details, of course. Every case would have to be assessed on its own merits. There could be harassment in that regard. So a criminal harassment with a hate element. Again, we have to look into each and every one. But again, I strongly encourage anybody who feels they are a victim of a hate incident or hate crime to call us or report it.
So I just wanted to say thanks, because I've contacted the equity division on the force a couple times, and I've always found them to be super helpful, very courteous, and had a lot of compassion to the situation that I was going under. So if folks are concerned about it, my personal experience has been very positive.
And Brian.
Thanks. Two things. First of all, I'm still reeling about the fact that there's only one officer who's able to be on the road today doing the road safety. Now, if that person, is that also the person who would, if he or she elected to, be using a radar gun, or would that be another? So if they decided to do that and they're sitting for 2 hours in one place, there's no other traffic. Yeah. You guys need more people.
Well, and so short answer, yeah, there's one person who's dedicated traffic today. If they're running radar at one location, then they're not running it at your location. If they have a major traffic accident that they attend to. So if you can imagine, so major car accidents, we also have folks who are reconstructionists. So they have to write a very complex report. Right. Those reports can take days. So now that's not to say that the other 10, so this one table here that's doing everything else, that's not to say that they can't do, like, you know, if they find speeding and all that stuff, but you have to calibrate that with the realization that the 200 calls that are coming in today, this table's going to split that 200 today. So, and if you can imagine, and I know this is it's a little bit anecdotal, but imagine the burden. If you folks right there, your table, you're going to deal with everything that happens in this city today. And then we talked about overtime before. You only have one table. And if you really need a day off because you've worked so much, but you know that if you take your day off, everybody else is going to have to do that much more, which is how we get into this constant grind of too much overtime. And people, that's where we get to burnout. Phil, it has to burnout because people, they don't want to let their community down. They don't want to let their team down. So in many respects, they go until they're broken. And we don't have a right to do that.
Hence the need for speed cameras. A lot of people say that a speed camera is a tax milk out. It isn't. If you're speeding, you're speeding, whether you're caught or not. The last thing is, I was involved in this directly. As the Guelph police getting involved with this gasoline problem that happened at Mobile, I've got $200 or $300 invested in this, but I don't know whether this is a police action.
That's a very, very good question, Brian. And for anyone who doesn't know, Brian was one of the people who discovered that cars don't run on water, and was interviewed by CTV on this. Just more evidence that you need an electric car.
Thanks, guys, for coming in and doing this. I can't help but be puzzled by the fact that you mentioned you had 300 plus people working for you, and yet there's only at any one time 11 people on the road in the city. And I understand the shift work involved, but I'm kind of curious what everybody else is doing.
That's a great question. So if you can imagine, so our frontline is approximately 100 and 110 people. So that the uniform frontline response. So that's split up into four platoons. So very rough numbers here, folks. Take 100 divided by two. So that's 25. Then you have that 25 in our industry. Sorry, divided by four. So 100 divided by four, you got 25. Automatically reduce that 25 by 10%. Because of people who have like long-term injuries and all that stuff. So reduce that number by 10%. Then reduce that number by a little bit because folks, somebody may break their leg at hockey. Or we have folks who take mat leave and pat leaves. So then reduce by another. So your 25 is down to, we'll say 20, 18. Then reduce that 18 by folks, you're allowed to get whole days. Right. So reduce that 18 down to 17, because maybe 3 out of 20 get to take a day off or like their, you know, their kid has a soccer game or whatever. So very quickly those numbers come down. So that's kind of how the front line looks for everybody else. For example, our detectives. So we have a drug unit that is dealing with drug issues throughout the city. Our traffic unit we've just described. What are we at? But 10. We've got about 10 people on traffic, 10 people divided by four, two and change. So that's how, if one person takes the day off, that's how you got the one. Our detectives, we had four homicides last year.
So it's not just the investigation of that. So when homicide happens, it's an incredible amount of resources to investigate that. But then you have to collate all that information. So it's months and months and months to investigate it, collate the data, work with the Crown. So then all your detectives are working on that. And often folks who might support our domestic violence or the one person that we don't have a human trafficking unit, but the one person who works on that may often, if there's a homicide or two or three or four on the go, then they get pulled into that because we've just had a homicide in the city. Then we have about 25 people in courts, who are special constables. So they're not sworn police officers, but they're special constables. For all the folks who go to court every day, we have a responsibility to manage security for the court. So that's about, there's those 20 people. And you see where I'm going with this? You can see how very quickly that's we have a small, so we have our drug unit who is anybody who spends, if you see Phil's emails or my emails, our drug unit's very busy. So all of these units very quickly, you can see, how they deplete very, very quickly. Was that helpful? Is that okay?
Actually, it was very helpful to me. I think that one of the things that was really laying out here is that we have an active core of 100, but with 300 staff, the question that I've got for you is, what are some of the other jobs? I know that there are those that answer the phones, but there's a tremendous support staff within police services that nobody sees or hears. What kinds of duties and responsibilities do they have?
Sure. Anybody here worked in a large organization, say greater than 100? Okay. So most people, when they think about policing, think of people dressed like us, right? But our civilian staff literally keep the lights on in our buildings, right? So out of the number that I gave you, we have our HR department. Has anybody here ever worked in HR? Thank you for the work that you do. Because if you've worked in HR, you know that HR are the unsung heroes in any organization. They are often they're often among the most overworked. They're often the least recognized and thanked. So thank you for everything that you did working in HR. So we have HR. We have a civilian that works, for example, in our forensic ident unit. To support some of the work that the sworn officers do. We have the unbelievably dedicated staff in our dispatch unit. Imagine coming to work every day and taking all the calls for people in their time of most need. So we have a couple dozen people there, 20 people there. Our fleet, policing relies a lot on vehicles. So we have our fleet coordinator as well as our vehicle outfitter who makes the vehicles work. We have our facility staff, right? We have our civilian staff who make sure our facility is maintained. And goodness, we have our legal counsel. We have so many folks who we literally couldn't operate the organization. Our finance, we have a finance team. So out of all those resources, we have facilities, fleet, finance, HR, materials management, our civilians who like the kit, the clothing, all that stuff that we were. So that's how 350, it sounds like a lot, but you can very quickly see how to run an organization. That's the numbers.
And each one of those four platoons has somebody going out for the donuts.
Phil, come on. I can't let that slide, Phil.
Okay. We still have a number of questions, and it's been a very enlightening time. There's a question that I've been asked to ask anonymously. I live in a house that has vulnerable tenants. Sometimes situations occur when interventions are needed. For example, a person sleeping outdoors on an uncovered porch and wet bedding at risk of hypothermia or incidents related to disturbances. Is there a group or an organization other than police to whom we should call in a situation like this?
So, I would say yes, but it depends on the time of day. So certainly, like, we have great service providers, CMHA, Helen Fishburn is one of the most amazing community leaders. So we have CMHA, we have other folks, but the reality is, we're the only 24/7 service available. So to that individual who asked that question, if you're not sure who to call, call us. We often talk about, very often we are not the most appropriate person to, we are not the most appropriate provider of social and housing and health services, but we are the only person very often. So,
and the non-emergency number, not the 911 number, is 519-824-1212. And what I've always done when I've had to call, and I have had to call quite often, is I've made it absolutely clear that I'm calling, that this is not an emergency, just to differentiate so that you do not get pulled into the 911 system as well. John.
Just a very quick one. What is the latest drug that you're seeing on the street? And can you clarify which are legal and which aren't?
It's a good question. So the drugs that are illegal are the ones who are, obviously that's a legislative thing. I'm going to actually have one of our drug guys get some better information, and maybe Phil can send that out. Because again, I spent many years in drug enforcement, but not lately. So I think I want to do the question justice.
Yeah. What I can say right now is the one that I understand is most common, and I'm going to get the name slightly wrong, is a fentanyl laced with a drug that begins with an X. And apparently it has created some significant problems for naloxone actually working, and I don't understand all the permutations. But what I discovered, John, is very interesting. Whereas when fentanyl first became a problem, we were seeing fentanyl coming in from offshore. What we're discovering now, and maybe Chief Kobe can respond to this, I understand that we now have, similar to meth houses, that we have fentanyl houses actually producing fentanyl in Canada and perhaps even in Guelph. I don't know whether you can comment on that or not.
I can't, but we can get back to you on that. And maybe have something you could send out to the audience.
Okay, thanks.
I'm wondering what one should do in the face of professional misconduct on the part of police officers. In the last decade, there's a couple of events that come to mind personally, which could have led to serious injury. Fortunately, didn't. But I just let them go. Well, one's documented and one isn't. But I just let them go simply because, frankly, I didn't feel safe. So could you comment, please?
Thank you for the question. Certainly don't want anybody in our community feeling unsafe. And if you have any interaction with a police officer that you don't feel was appropriate, there are certainly avenues for you to make a complaint. We do have some of our folks are in our professional standards branch that investigate police conduct or misconduct. And we take it very seriously. Certainly we, like the chief had said earlier, we certainly want to build trust with our community. We don't want to break it down. And if somebody makes a mistake, that's one thing. If their behavior wasn't appropriate, perhaps it's training, perhaps it's more than that. So I would strongly encourage you. There's certainly different avenues that a complaint can take. We can have a local resolution where it's sort of worked out at a lower level, depending on what it is. Then there is the OIPRD. They have their own website where anybody can make a complaint about police conduct. OIPRD, the Office of the Independent Police Review Department. Yeah, OIPRD. If you were to Google and put Ontario Police Complaints, I'm pretty confident that site would come up. And a complaint could be submitted through them. We have documents at the station that if somebody wanted, we would provide if they wanted to make a complaint. There's certainly a lot of oversight. Of course, if it's something that's very serious, the SIU is going to get involved and investigate. So there's a lot of avenues to make a complaint against a police officer. Obviously, we don't want that to be the case. We want our officers to be the most professional and serve the public as best they can. But if there were questions, like I said, I would recommend that you can contact our professional services branch.
And right on our website, there's a compliments or complaints section that you could just go right on our website, and everything Steve just told you, those links are all available there.
This has been tremendously informative. We did not get to questions on downtown and homelessness. We did not get to questions on the auto theft funding that was announced by the federal and the provincial government. But we covered a myriad of issues that I think are very important. And I do have assurances from Chief Kobe that they will be back, that this is a part of what they consider to be part of the mandate of open, transparent discussion of issues of policing in Guelph. So I want to thank you three gentlemen for having attended here. And there are no actual announcements today, but Morgan has an actual announcement.
Just a reminder to everybody, next week starts Throwback Thursdays. Breezy Breakfast goes old school analog. Our hope is that we will be able to review the public space uses draft bylaw that is out today and see what's in there. Hope to see you here in restaurant only. The Breezy Bullhorn will be published throughout February. And if you have ideas for week 3 and week 4 about the focus of our conversation, that would be great. We're looking at February 15th, getting an update from Brian Skerritt on what's happening with the urban park. And I got an email that it was read into the House of Commons yesterday.
Lovely. And Phil, can I just have like, I just want to say thank everyone again. Phil had called and said, I know it's last minute. Can you come? We are always happy to come. And I think that often this is the best way to have a discussion is just you have questions and we answer them. And so sometimes I won't be able to answer, but it's our job to be here. It's our pleasure to be here. And for the folks sitting at this table, if you can imagine, and again, thank you for everything you did in HR, because really unsung heroes, but imagine there's 8 people sitting at this table and you know you're coming to work and you're going to support 150,000 people every day. So I really, on that note, it's important for me to publicly thank our folks and all the work they do. Steve, Andrew and I, we're here. You see our faces, but there's so many folks that are working hard for our citizens that you don't see. So I just want to say thanks to them personally too. Thanks.
That's all for today. Please note that we're on hiatus during February. Tune in to CFRU 93.3 FM every Monday morning at 9 a.m. or listen to the Breezy Breakfast podcast. Breezy Breakfast. The eggs might be scrambled, but the conversation is anything but.